Hello and welcome to the Gentleman's Journal podcast, a fortnightly discussion show all about success, modern business and the lives of entrepreneurs. I'm Joe Bullmore, I'll be your host for the day, and I'm joined this afternoon in the games room at Mark's Club by Arthur Kay, the founder and CEO of BioBean. BioBean's an award-winning clean energy company that recycles old coffee grounds and turns them into advanced biofuels. It's a beautifully simple idea and one that has huge implications across the entire world of energy and fuels. It's also Arthur's first business. He chanced upon the core thoughts while studying for a degree in architecture and kicked off the company just a few days after he graduated. Today, Arthur tells us how ideas mean nothing without execution, about the dangers of being labelled a green entrepreneur, and how he hopes to hack the world's major cities one problem at a time. Arthur, thanks very much for coming to speak to us. The idea behind BioBean is so simple and elegant. That it's almost surprising that no one's thought of it before, if you'll forgive me saying that. When you first thought of it, were you kind of wary that this can't work for some reason?
Well, you're exactly right. That was my first concern. So I was studying architecture at the time, and so from an entirely different perspective. And when I came up with the idea, I was convinced either it wouldn't work or that it would work, and therefore there'd be hundreds of other companies all across the world doing it. And it was really through coming at it from that, I guess, slightly left-field perspective that I managed to started working on the idea, developed the technology, and found out that it could work. And also, bizarrely, there was no one else in the world doing it.
So what was that light bulb moment? How did you first realise that there was so much waste coffee and that we could put it to use?
Yeah, it was really driven by that, the understanding the sheer volume of waste coffee grounds that there were out there. So at the time, I was studying, as I say, architecture here in London at UCL, and I was designing, bizarrely, a coffee shop and coffee factory, looking really at how you can make that a sustainable and efficient process.
Yeah.
And it was on the understanding that when you make instant coffee, there's actually a huge amount of waste coffee grounds in that process. When it dissolves in your cup, I never really made the intellectual leap thinking there must be coffee somewhere on that supply chain. It's simply not in your cup, it's all the way up the supply chain in these vast factories. And understanding the volume of it, and also that you can turn that into valuable fuels and chemicals. In the UK alone, we produce about 500,000 tons of waste coffee grounds each year. Wow. And not only is that terrible for the environment, it also critically costs the industry a lot of money, about £80 million a year to get rid of.
Yeah.
And so BioBean is trying to tack into all of that waste and save the company's money and make renewable fuels off the back of it.
It's kind of infuriatingly simple, and it's one of those things that people, when they've heard it, must have thought, why didn't I think of that? But to have the courage to pursue that at, how old were you, 21?
I was 23 when I came up with the idea, and then been working on it for, 22 when I came up with the idea, and working on it for about 4 years now.
So where was the moment of change when you decided this, how did it change from this is a good idea to this is a business idea I'm going to pursue?
Well, it was really, when I came up with the idea, I originally kind of sidled up to my parents and suggested dropping out of university and going and setting up the company, to which the answer was very swift, no, you will not. And so I finished my architecture degree and then set it up literally the next day after graduating, and have been working on it for the years ever since.
Did you always want to be an entrepreneur? That seems like a kind of madly driven thing, not even to take a week of holiday and go straight into a new business.
No, I never really wanted to be an entrepreneur or specifically go into business. What I've always been interested in is around this idea of sustainable cities and how you can deliver impactful change in urban centres. And so this felt like a very natural transition for me to go and do something. It just so happened that the vehicle for change was a limited company rather than through architectural design, which had been my passion previously.
So talk us through day one when you're sitting there and you've got this grand idea, this huge scheme, and zero chemical or biochemical experience. What did you do on that first morning?
So it was an unproven technology, an unproven business model, an unproven concept in itself, and also, sadly, I was an unproven business leader myself. And so it was really very incremental. I remember putting together our first business plan, which I think suggested that in 9 months we'd have our first factory built and up and running.
Wow.
And it was only going to cost us $1 million, which is amazing. It took us much longer and cost us a lot more than that. Right. So it was through kind of very incremental process.
With an idea that's so it hinges so much on a single piece of intellectual property, were you terrified about going and presenting that to people, whether for investment or for advice? And how did you safeguard the idea?
No, you're exactly right. At first, I was very concerned around, if it's such a good idea, people are going to try and steal it and all the rest of it. And I was nervous about that for probably the first 6 months or so. Beyond that point, I've just been trying to get it out there and tell everyone I can. We patented the idea quite early on, and after that, I was just talking to as many people as I could get my hands on. The real piece that made me kind of confident that no one was going to steal it was that, as with, you know, ideas are all around us and they're very easy to come up with. The challenging thing is execution. And so the idea was really, the thing that stood with me was that if the people are going to be, you know, not bright enough to come up with their own idea and to nick a 23-year-old's idea, then they're definitely not bright enough to go and actually execute on this very complex supply chain and business endeavor. And so that's what kind of made me confident that we could do it.
So what were the kind of stumbling blocks in the early days? What were the complexities of that supply chain? What was the resistance that you came across?
The complexities, I think, to an extent, they were similar as with all businesses. There are things like raising finance, building a team, developing the technology. But probably the thing that was unique to Biobean, or enhanced more so with Biobean, was around the chicken and egg nature of it. You know, we couldn't grow incrementally like a software business or a or even a kind of, you know, business selling trousers or whatever it happens to be. We had to actually build the factory and develop a supply chain up, both in terms of feedstock and in terms of sales, from scratch. And the challenge behind that is vast, because building a factory is not a cheap hobby. And so going and doing that costs millions and millions of pounds.
Yeah, and it must have been daunting as a 23, 24-year-old to go to those huge companies and sit in front of them and say, you've got to believe in me. Were you particularly good at pitching back then, or did you leave that side of the business to someone else?
It wasn't a formal pitch in the sense going in and giving a presentation. It was just meeting people within the organisations and finding out what their problems were. And, you know, a lot of the things we now know, we didn't know at the time. So just understanding the sheer volume of coffee out there was one of the things, you know, the 500,000 tons, but also understanding the significant cost and hassle it is to the waste management industry. That, you know, people think of waste, you know, you put it in the bin and it vanishes magically and you pay your council tax or whatever it happens to be. But the actual complexities of that infrastructure and supply chain were things that we had to drill down into. And the more we understood about it, the more we understood that our solution could actually save not just our clients money in terms of the coffee companies themselves, but also could actually solve a lot of problems and save money for the waste management industry itself. And so it was that kind of double-edged win which really helped get the business off the ground in the early years.
And it seems like an incredibly millennial, if you excuse that slightly tired phrase, a very millennial business, in that coffee is the most popular drink ever, and it's in its most popular phase, and there are more high street coffee brands than ever. And also it's dealing with waste and turning it into something positive. Do you think you're kind of on the vanguard of a new wave of millennial startups, and do you feel like a millennial figurehead?
I'd certainly do. I mean, I know what you mean in terms of it's definitely kind of zeitgeisty at the moment in terms of all, it ticks a lot of buzzwords.
Sure.
But the raw element of it in terms of what the circular economy, when it's done well, is about. Because I think often it's projects are pitched as circular economy or, you know, recycling projects, but they're done at a very, very bespoke or cottage industry scale, which is not to say that's a bad thing. It's just that it's not what Biobean is about. The key thing when it's done well is around essentially the macroeconomics behind it. Because the way that circular businesses can to have a competitive advantage over conventional businesses is around the economic advantage one can drive from it. So the fact that we're able to take waste away for a fraction of the price of sending it to landfill is a huge advantage. It's not about it being green, it's about it being good monetary sense to give it to Biobean rather than to send it to conventional waste management company. Similarly with our fuels, buying one of our products like our coffee logs, for example, it's cheaper than buying a conventional piece of wood or a coal product. And it's, again, it's not about it being a, you know, sexy new renewable fuel or it being created by someone who's, you know, in their 20s. It's about it being a really high performance, low cost fuel that happens to be renewable. And it's really from that perspective, and we're trying to do that at scale, and it's from that perspective that, you know, we're trying to grow the company over the coming years, and not just in the UK but also eventually internationally as well.
So do you brand yourself as a green entrepreneur or as an energy entrepreneur? And do you shy away almost then from the term green if it's...
I shy away a bit from the kind of the young or the green element of it. Not that I don't think those are important or what we are doing, but simply by the fact that it has to first and foremost be a fantastic business that makes money and does great things for the world, not just it being green and therefore we're great. And I think too often within the kind of sustainability agenda, it's been relying on the fact that, hoping that people are going to say, you know, get that warm fuzzy feeling and say it's green, therefore I got to do it. No, it's got to first and foremost be a better product and a cheaper product and green.
Wow. So how much more efficient then is your fuel or your biofuels or your logs than their equivalents? Are they twice as good? Are they?
They're about, so in terms of cost, they're about just twice as good. In terms of their energy output, they have about 50% more energy output per per log. So they, so if you burn a wood log compared to a bag of wood logs compared to a bag of coffee logs, we'll get about 50% on top of that, again at no extra cost there. And also in terms of the whole experience of using them, we're trying to make that a enjoyable element. In terms, you know, you can buy it online with free delivery, for example. Yeah. You can go to your local garage and pick it up, and you know, your local supermarket. So it's trying to make it as seamless as possible and not make a song and dance about it being a special product. It's just a better than what you bought last week.
So why are we all not then just using coffee logs all the time? Well, I mean, it seems like it's a no-brainer.
That's certainly the plan. I mean, we only launched the coffee log 6 months ago, and it went straight away to the number one best-selling briquette on Amazon. Wow. We've been stocked by some of the biggest retailers in the UK, so we're currently at the moment, you know, struggling to keep up with demand for the product. So it's had a phenomenally good start. Admittedly, in quite a niche industry, in terms of the briquette and log market is not necessarily, you know, the iTunes of the world, but it's, you know, we've done well within our sphere, and it's now looking to grow Biobean through different product streams and through different services as well.
And do people have reservations about using coffee in their cars or burning coffee in their barbecues? Do they think it's kind of a bit of an unusual thing to do?
Yes. We haven't noticed that to date, but it's certainly, you know, we have to make sure the fuels are fully certified. It's a heavy, both in terms of the collection services, the waste management piece, and also in terms of the fuels and the chemicals we produce. These are, you know, heavily certified, and you know, health and safety is to be taken into account at all times, but we've made sure that we've got all the certification, everything in place to be able to actually you know, get through that legislation and to be able to sell the fuels as you would do alongside other fuels and chemicals.
So you're kind of now, you've been on lots of TV shows and sort of giving presentations all over the world about this company. Have you found lots of people approaching you and pitching their sustainable or their waste or their circular ideas to you?
Yeah, so we get approached by a lot of people coming up with new ideas or wanting to work with us, both here in the UK and also internationally as well. The key thing I always try and stress to people is around delivering it at scale, because as I say, I think the cottage industry element to it is important, and it's often inspiring at a local level. But the key thing that what we need for, you know, this to be a global movement is to have solutions which work, you know, at a local scale, at a city scale, at a national scale, and at an international scale as well. And that scalability is often underlooked and as important as the kind of the commercial pieces which I mentioned earlier.
So at what scale do you think you'll have made it? When will you, Arthur K, be happy that Biobean has arrived and is the new Shell or the new
PP? Yeah. I basically think that there's a, you know, coffee is an element of it.
Yeah.
We want to get to the point that we're processing in the next couple of years at least half of the UK's waste coffee grounds, and then looking to scale beyond that initially to Europe. But outside of Biobean, my interest is around how waste generally can be seen not as waste. Waste is a subjective definition that humans put on resources, and I basically see it as that waste is just a resource simply in the wrong place.
Right.
And if you can find ways to understand that is not waste, and that is find efficient ways to collect it and aggregate it, then you can turn all of these literally billions of tons of waste stuff filling the blank into valuable commodities, and whether that be, in our case, it's fuels and chemicals, but it might be a whole host of other potential applications.
Sure, but not everything has a high caloric, is that the right word?
Calorific
value. And not everything can be turned into fuel. I mean, waste paper, that's recycled, but what other products are there that can be turned from waste into something useful easily?
So if we just take a small geographic area, if we just take the UK, for example, there are a whole host of potential waste streams in the UK that could be really excitingly valorized. So there's waste from the sweet industry. So there's really? high energy and also potential applications for waste from you know, big sweet processes. But also, interestingly, there are literally millions of tons from the beer and brewery industry.
Wow.
And so that is highly calorific, also has an oil content, which could be valuable too.
Yeah.
But one I'm particularly interested in at the moment is waste from the whiskey industry, which is slightly, wow, you know, I like coffee, I like whiskey. It's a good trend to follow. But again, you've got a solid waste and also a liquid waste, and that can be turned into some very interesting fuels and chemicals as well.
Sure.
But also, I'd say it's not specifically organic waste, and it's also not specifically fuels and chemicals. An example I often like to share is that in electronics waste, there's, you know, if you take your leftover iPhones or your, you know, computers, televisions, etc., there's more gold in a ton of electronics waste than there is in the richest gold ore in the world. And so, if you know, there's this concept of urban mining, which was one of the original kind of nuggets of an idea which I latched on early on with Biobean. And you know, understanding that you can actually buy landfill sites. There are people who are currently starting to buy landfill sites and starting to mine them for their historic, you know, people from the 50s, 60s, and 70s for their historic resources. Wow. I'm really taking this idea that it is literally a mine of resources. It's just around finding the technology and the product market fit to then actually scale these properly.
Wow. So it sounds like this is kind of the first wave of a revolution where almost anything can be turned into fuel. That if I was an executive at Shell or Exxon, that would be quite a daunting proposition. Have you encountered any resistance from the big boys of energy?
Not yet. To date, it's been quite a lot of support from a lot of the people in the industry because they do see it as the future. The debate is how, you know, most of the big energy companies accept that renewables are going to be the future. The debate is not if, it's when. And so it's how rapidly, you know, companies and countries can transition from a primarily fossil-based society to a renewable one. And so that period of transition is the critical thing, and making sure that there are companies that are growing steadily through that period, because it's a very different proposition from a software company where, you know, you can build a product and essentially scale exponentially through that.
Yeah.
We are limited through the limits of hardware, the limits of building factories, and also the realities of, you know, financing that growth. And so the key thing is working in partnership with a number of these bigger energy companies to scale through that. And that's where, you know, we found support in the UK from companies such as Shell, and also through companies such as Centrica, who have supported us financially, and also through partnerships and often buying a lot of our products as well.
And do you think one day you'd like to, is the plan to exit to one of those companies, to sell out to Shell or Centrica?
No, the plan with Biobean is still to keep it private and to grow the company. I mean, there's such a vast opportunity within the space that we want to make sure that we grow to a significant point and want to, you know, displace some of these companies in terms of a lot of what they do as well.
And what's the biggest threat? What keeps you up at night? What are you worried about happening that would just undo all your hard work?
No one drinking any more coffee.
Right.
No, the biggest threat is, you know, it's the boring stuff. It's around kind of just making sure, you know, it's around operating factories. And, you know, at the end of the day, we're kind of on the brink of kind of a new industrial revolution, and just making sure that, you know, we manage that growth in a sustainable way and a steady way as well.
Yeah. How difficult was it to get people who were more experienced with you and presumably quite a lot older than you on board? And have you found it tough managing people who have been in the industry, say, for 20 years?
Yeah, it's been definitely a big kind of journey in terms of that. But it's just being very open with them and saying, you know, this is my idea and, you know, I'd love to have you as part of it. And so it's getting people excited and getting them on that journey. But it's, I definitely wouldn't have been able to do it without that level of experience. I mean, in our executive team, I'm the youngest person by 2 decades probably. Right. And, you know, these are hugely experienced people from GlaxoSmithKline, from Centrica, from Shell, from Drax. So these are, you know, very, very smart and driven and experienced people. And working with them and getting them on board has been critical to it. Yeah.
And do you think your youth has then helped or been a kind of hindrance in the early stages?
I think it's a double-edged sword, because I think realistically, if I'd known what it was going to take, I probably wouldn't have gone after the idea. As in, you know, when I first wrote that business plan, looking back on it now, it's laughably naive. Okay. And in, you know, 3 years' time, I'll probably be looking back on our current business plan and saying the same thing.
Right.
But it's you know, that optimism and naivety to an extent has helped in terms of really getting excited about the idea and feeling that it is possible, and then people coming in and saying, well, God, if this guy thinks it's possible, let's go for it, kind of thing. So it is that to an extent. But, you know, looking back on it now, it certainly seems absolutely mad that I would have written that and given it a go.
Yeah. What were the toughest moments along the way in those early days?
I think a lot of the toughest moments were around the team, but also the most exciting moments as well. So, you know, getting that team right, and also when you're working well with someone and you know, something goes wrong, or, you know, those sorts of elements are the kind of the real bits, because everything feels very personal, very kind of intense. Yeah.
And did you ever feel like chucking it all in, throwing the towel in?
No, because when you get very passionate and very driven by something, it doesn't even cross your mind. You can just head down and in delivery mode. And it has been that case. I mean, I say it's been nearly 4 years now, and it's just been head down and just getting the job done. And often people get, as they very caught up in the idea and too focused on what an excellent idea it is, but it is actually around just making sure that every day you're getting that 1% better, or you know, taking it that little bit further.
Yeah.
And being very delivery focused has been critical to where we've got to so far. And we just need to make sure we keep that focus.
So what's the next step then? What's next for BioBean?
So the next things for us are, I mean, our focus for the coming year is around, in the UK, is around growing our feedstock collection pipeline. So working with cafes, with restaurant chains, with instant coffee manufacturers, waste management companies to collect as much coffee as we can get our hands on. As they currently, we have a good chunk of the UK coffee market. We want to grow that massively over the coming years. On the flip side, it's around making sure, you know, to your earlier points around getting the coffee logs in front of as many consumers as possible, and really making sure it's the default fuel that if people are lighting up a chimney this summer or a wood burning fire this winter, that they think, well, I'll get my coffee logs on instead.
Yeah.
And then we've got a number of really exciting product launches in the pipeline, which are coming soon, we've been working on for a long time, but which will launch in the next couple of months, which we're very excited about.
Brilliant. What advice would you have to anyone looking to get into a similar industry right now?
I would say to spend a lot of time up front thinking about the business model. I think a lot of time, you know, I think primarily from West Coast United States, we're sold this idea that technology solves the problems. You know, when in doubt, make your technology slightly better. And technology is almost by definition agnostic as to its application. So the obvious example is you can use a brick to build a house or to hit someone on the back of the head.
Yeah.
And so technology can be used for good, but it can also not be. And so to make sure that when you're setting up a business, to make sure you focus as much on the business model or more on the business model than you do on the technology. Because, you know, as the saying goes, the future's already there, it's just not evenly distributed yet.
Right.
And so you need to make sure you find technologies, often these can be off-the-shelf technologies, and find a really exciting business model that can deliver that change. And if we get more entrepreneurs focusing on how the business model can deliver not just value, but also good to society in terms of its environmental and social impact, I think we'll build a much better future for everyone.
And do you think lots of young green entrepreneurs kind of hope that their business will get by on the warm and fuzzy feeling of being environmentally friendly?
I think so. I mean, to my mind, it's the combination of thinking that because it's green, it will work, and also because your technology at a lab scale is 10% better than what's already out there, it's going to work as well. 10% better at a lab scale means absolutely nothing. It needs to be an order of magnitude better for it to be a technology company. Otherwise, rely on business model innovation, not technological innovation.
And are you particularly environmentally conscious in your day-to-day life? Do you?
Yeah, I mean, massively, but I also think that, I mean, in terms of, you know, all the obvious things in terms of cycling around and walking robots and all those sorts of things, but the key thing is around, you need a system to change rather than than individuals to make a slightly incremental improvement in how they live, because the fundamental lifestyle and system that supports what we are doing and living as we do in the developed world is so unsustainable that it's not even worth repeating on this podcast.
Right.
It's very well written about elsewhere. And so it's around finding ways in which you can make meaningful change within a system as opposed to making incremental change in your own life.
And those systems, I suppose, as far as you're concerned, are cities. And which cities are the kind of gold standard of sustainability, and which ones are particularly bad offenders? How does London fall in that chart?
London's pretty good. I mean, one of the key elements in cities is around density. So it's how you can make it's what's called kind of livable density work. Yeah. And so think really simple things like making cities that you want to walk through rather than and are walkable is a big step. So actually, the centre of London London generally is actually pretty sustainable on that very simple metric. But it's finding ways in which you can hack into the urban fabric in a way that citizens and companies can hack into the urban fabric and make them denser and more livable, rather than and BioBean's a small example of that, but rather than just hoping that someone in government or local government is going to solve it for you, it's around kind of going out and doing stuff.
And which city does it best then? Which country is particularly good at making this easy for its citizens to hack into?
A number of the really rapidly growing cities in China are very good at it, not necessarily in the most the best sense always, because it's a bit of chaos over there, and sometimes when it's done badly, but in the sense that it is truly malleable, that the city is there for people to take control of and do what they want with it. But I think in a historic example, if you look at some of the city states of Italy, yeah, in terms of kind of very, very dense, very economically prosperous, still to this day, a lot of them, but very dense and very livable cities in terms of how they mix, commerce with industry and with living space as well, but that's not explicitly a sustainable way, yeah, but the way that it's a very nice place to live and it is sustainable and it's economically viable, right, and that combination is where we need to be focusing on, rather than just saying this is sustainable therefore go for it, but then you forget, yeah, about the livability element.
And have you ever spoken to government, either on a local level or even the national level, about these ideas and how we can implement them in?
Increasingly so. To date, I've been pretty focused on the day job, but kind of getting increasingly kind of enthused about that, and do some work advising the mayor's office around that too. So, but only on a kind of part time basis.
And might you one day run for office yourself, Mayor of London, Arthur Kay?
No, not for me, sadly.
Brilliant. I'd like to try a new segment we're going to do, which is a set of quick fire questions.
Great.
So you have to answer those as quickly as possible, hopefully to get a better idea of Arthur Kay the person as much as Arthur Kay the businessman. So, who in the world of business do you most admire?
Probably Terence Conran. Wow. Mainly because I think the way that he took kind of really high-end design and democratized it, made it, possible for the man in the Clapham Omnibus to be able to access it and cheaply and well, has been really inspiring to me.
And what would you be doing if you weren't doing this?
Something in the built environment. I studied architecture, and that's still my real passion. Not necessarily to become an architect, but to make cities sustainable is my real drive.
Great. What single moment are you most proud of in your career?
Finishing the factory, getting it right. the first pellets and coffee logs coming off the line was so inspiring.
And on the flip side, what has been your greatest moment of defeat or regret?
Most days.
Really? I'm sure that's not true.
No, it's a good, it's a hard slog, so
And what's your most treasured physical possession?
My Moleskine notebook, probably.
Wow, yeah. Filled with $1 million ideas.
Lots of drawings, lots of sketches of kind of little designs and solutions to engineering problems, that kind
and
of stuff.
And doodles and
exactly
other things.
Yeah,
are you a very visual person or more words?
Yeah, no, I think through drawing basically. Yeah.
Brilliant. What book has influenced you the most?
Good question. Probably Evelyn Waugh's Scoop, I think.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, brilliant. So you maybe harbour ambitions to be a journalist yourself?
Not quite, but it's a great book, though. And also just how kind of tongue-in-cheek the world is, in terms of, what causes stuff to happen is not necessarily as logical as people might want to think.
Absolutely. How would you like your Wikipedia entry to start? What's that first line going to be? Arthur Kay is a...
Designer.
Designer?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
You can have more than one word.
I'd say urban designer.
Okay. Brilliant. Urban designer, philanthropist. Nothing like that.
Exactly.
And what, if you have one, is your personal motto?
My personal motto? I don't yet have one. But if I did, it'd probably be hack the city or something like that.
The city?
Yeah.
Wow. Brilliant. Arthur Kay, thank you very much for coming to speak to us.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you very, very much for listening to this episode of the Gentleman's Journal podcast. We'll be back in a fortnight with more invaluable insights from the world of entrepreneurs. But until then, you can find us on our website, which is www.thegentlemansjournal.com. Or if you're so inclined, follow us on Instagram at The Gents Journal, or indeed on Twitter at The Gents Journal. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you very, very soon.